passed it on to Smokey. "What's he done?" Sipsy brought the coffee, and Curtis Smoot, the wiry, skinny one with the neck that looked like a wrinkled arm sticking out of a white shirt, said in a high-pitched, tight little voice,
"He ain't done nothing that we know of. We're trying to find out what's been did to him."
Smokey handed the pitcher back. "No, I ain't never seed him. What you looking for him over here for?"
"He told some old boy who worked for him over in Georgia that he was coming over here a couple of days ago, and he never did come back home."
Smokey asked whereabouts in Georgia.
"Valdosta."
"Well, I wonder what he was a-coming over here for," Smokey said. Idgy turned around and called out to the kitchen, "Sipsy, bring us a couple of pieces of that chocolate pie out here." Then she said to Officer Riggins, "I want you to try a piece of this for me. Tell me what you think. We just made it a few minutes ago. Have a piece on me." Officer Riggins protested, "No, I couldn't, really. I..." Idgy said, "Oh, come on, just a bite. I need an expert opinion." "Well, okay. Just a bite, then." The skinny one squinted at Idgy.
"I told these boys that he most likely is on a drunk somewhere and gonna show up in the next day or so. What I can't figure out is what he was coming over here for. There ain't nothing here."
Wendell said between bites, "We figure maybe he had a girlfriend around here or something." Grady exploded with laughter.
"Hell, ain't no woman in Whistlestop that somebody would come all the way from Georgia for."
Then he paused.
"Except maybe Eva Bates."
Then all three of them laughed, and Smokey, who also had the pleasure of knowing Eva in the biblical sense, said,
"That's the God's truth."
Grady started in on the other piece of pie, still amused at his own joke. But the skinny man was serious, and he leaned over the table to Grady.
"Who's Eva Bates?"
"Oh, she's just an old red-headed gal that runs a joint over by the river," Grady said. "A friend of ours."
"You think this Eva woman might be the one he came over for?"
Grady, eating his pie, glanced over at the photo on the table and dismissed the thought.
"Nah, not in a million years."
The skinny one persisted.
"Why not?"
"Well, for one thing, he ain't her type."
They all three laughed again. Wendell Riggins chuckled along with them, although he didn't know why. Officer Smoot said,
"What do you mean, not her type?"
Grady put his fork down.
"Now, I don't want to hurt your feelings or nothing, and I don't even know this old boy in the picture here, but he looks a little sissified to me. Wouldn't you say so, Smokey?"
Smokey agreed.
"Nah, the truth is, boys, Eva would take one look at him and throw him back in the water."
They all laughed again.
Smoot said, "Well, I guess you know what you're talking about,"
and squinted his eyes at Idgy again.
"Yeah, well, that's just the facts of life," Grady continued.
He winked at Idgy and Smokey.
"From what I hear, all you boys over in Georgia is a little light on your feet."
Smokey sat there giggling.
"That's the way I heard it."
Grady leaned back in his chair and patted his stomach.
"Well, I guess we better head on out of here. We got a few more stops to make before dark,"
and put the picture back in his pocket. As they all got up to go, Officer Riggins said,
"Thanks for the pie, Mrs.
Idgy.
Mrs. Idgy, it sure was delicious. Thank you again."
"You're welcome." Grady got his hat.
"You're going to see them again. I'm going to bring them back tomorrow for some barbecue."
"Good. Be happy to see you."
Grady looked around to the back. "By the way, where's Ruth?"
"She's over at Mama's house. Mama's been real sick." Grady said, "Yeah, that's what I heard. I'm real sorry to hear that." "Well, see you tomorrow." And they headed out the door. Although it was only 4:30 in the afternoon, the sky was already a gunmetal gray with silver streaks shooting across the north, and the winter rain that had just started was as thin and cold as ice water. Next door, the windows of Opal's beauty shop had already been decorated with blinking Christmas lights that reflected on the wet sidewalk. Inside, Opal's shampoo girl was sweeping up, and Christmas music was playing on the radio. Opal was finishing up her last customer, Mrs. Vesta Adcock, who was going to an L&N banquet in Birmingham that night. The bells on the door jangled as Grady and the men came in, and Grady put on his official voice. "Opal, can we speak to you for a minute?" Vesta Adcock looked up horrified and clutched her flowered smock around her, screaming, "What in the world?" Opal looked up, equally horrified, and rushed over to Grady with a green comb in her hand. "You can't come in here, Grady Kilgore. This here is a beauty shop. We don't let men in here. What's the matter with you? Have you lost your mind? Now go on, get out." "The very idea." The 6'4" Grady and the two men stumbled all over each other trying to get out the door and wound up back on the sidewalk with Opal glaring at them through the foggy window. Grady put the photograph of Frank Bennett back in his pocket and said, "Well, that's one place he ain't been in, that's for damn sure." The three men pulled up their collars and headed across the tracks. Whistle Stop Cafe, Whistle Stop, Alabama, December 21st, 1930. 3 days after the two men from Georgia had first arrived in town asking questions about Frank Bennett, the skinny one, Curtis Smoot, came in by himself and ordered another barbecue and an orange crush. When Itchy brought it over to the booth, she said, "Between Grady and your partner, y'all are about to eat up all my barbecue. That makes 10 you three have had today." He squinted at her and said in his high nasal little voice, "Have a seat." Iggy looked around the room and saw that it wasn't busy, and then sat down across from him. He took a bite of his sandwich and looked at her hard. "How you doing?" Iggy said. "Found that man you was looking for yet?" This time he glanced around the room and then leaned across the table, his face like a razor. "You're not fooling me, girly girl. I know who you are. Don't think for a minute you're fooling me. You gotta get up early in the morning to put one over on Curtis Smoot. Yes, sir, the first time I come in here I knowed I'd seen you somewhere before, but I couldn't place you. So I made a few phone calls, and last night it come to me who you were." He sat back and continued eating, never taking his eyes off her. Iggy, not batting an eye, waited for him to continue. "Now, I got me a sworn statement from this fella Jake that works out at the Bennett place that someone answering the description of you and that big black buck you got out in the back there come over with a bunch and took Bennett's wife off, and that nigger threatened Bennett with a knife." He picked a piece of dark meat out of his sandwich and put it on his plate and looked at it. "Besides that, I was in the back of the barber shop that day, and me and a whole bunch heard you threaten to kill him. Now, if I can remember, you can be damn sure the rest of them will." He took a swig of his cold drink and wiped his mouth with the paper napkin. "Now, I can't say Frank Bennett was no particular friend of mine. No, sir. I got my oldest girl living in a shack outside of town with a kid because of him. And I heard tell of what was going on out at his place. And I would venture a guess that they is others that wouldn't shed a tear if he was to show up dead.
But it looks to me, girly girl, that you would be in a whole passel of trouble if he did. 'Cause the fact that you threatened him twice is in the official record, and I can tell you right now, that don't look too good in black and white. What we're talking about here, girlie, is murder, running afoul of the law, and nobody can get away with that. He leaned back in the booth and took on a casual air. Now, of course, just hypothetically speaking, of course, if it was me in your shoes, why, I'd figure it would do me a whole lot of good if that body didn't show up at all. Yes, a whole lot of good. Or if anything that belonged to him was to be found, for that matter. I'd figure it wouldn't bode well if anybody could prove that Frank Bennett had been over here at all, you understand? And I'd figure, if I was smart, that is, it would be real important to make sure there wasn't nothing to find. He glanced up at Iggy to make sure she was listening. She was. Yes, sir, that would be too bad, 'cause I'd have to come back over here and arrest you and your colored man on suspicion. Now, I'd hate to come back over here after you, but I will, 'cause I'm the law, and I'm sworn to uphold it. You can't beat the law. Do you understand that? Iggy said, "Yes, sir." Having made his point, he pulled a quarter out of his pocket and threw it on the table, put his hat on, and said as he was leaving, "Of course, Grady may be right. He may just show back up at home one of these days. But I ain't gonna hold my breath."
Valdosta Gazette, January 7, 1931. Local man feared dead. The search for Frank Bennett, 38, a lifelong resident of Valdosta, missing from his home since early morning, December 13 of last year, has officially ended. The extensive search, conducted by Detective Curtis Smoot and Detective Wendell Riggins, led to people being questioned as to Bennett's whereabouts as far away as Tennessee and Alabama. However, neither Bennett nor the truck in which he was traveling at the time of the disappearance has been recovered. "We left no stone unturned," said Officer Smoot in an interview early today. "He just seems to have vanished off the face of the earth." The Weems Weekly, Whistle Stop Alabama's weekly bulletin, March 19, 1931. Sad news for all of us. After having lost their daddy a year before, it was another sad trip home for Leona, Mildred, Patsy Ruth, and Edward Threadgood, who all came back home for their mother's funeral. After the service, we all went over to the Threadgood house, and everyone in town must have been there to pay their respects to Mama Threadgood. Half the people here practically grew up over at the Threadgood house with she and Papa. I can never forget the good times we had over there, and how she always made us feel so welcome. As for me, I met my better half over there at one of their big 4th of July parties. We courted with Cleo and Ninny, and many an hour was spent sitting on that front porch after church. Everybody is going to miss her, and the place is not going to seem the same without her. Dot Weems. Rose Terrace Nursing Home, Old Montgomery Highway, Birmingham, Alabama, May 11, 1986. Evelyn Couch opened the plastic baggie full of carrot sticks and celery she had brought for herself and offered them to her friend. Mrs. Threadgood declined, but went on eating her orange marshmallow peanuts. "No, thank you, honey. Raw food just doesn't sit well with me." "Why are you eating raw food, anyway?"
"It's Weight Watchers. Well, kind of. I can eat anything I want as long as it doesn't have fat or sugar in it."
"Are you trying to slim down again?"
Yes, I'm going to try. But it's hard. I've gotten so fat.
Well, you do what you want to, but I still say you look fine to me.
Oh, Mrs. Threadgood, you're sweet to say so, but I've gotten up to a size 16.
You don't look heavy to me. Essie Rue, now she was heavy set. But then she was always inclined in that direction ever since she was a little girl. But I guess at one time she got up to well over 200 pounds.
She did?
Oh, yes. But she never let it bother her, and she always dressed up in the best-looking outfits and always had a little flower in her hair to match. Everybody used to say that Essie Rue looked like she had just stepped out of a bandbox, and she had the cutest little hands and feet. Everybody in Birmingham used to talk about what cute little feet she had when she got her job playing the Mighty Wurlitzer.
The what?
The Mighty Wurlitzer organ. They had it down at the Alabama Theater for years. They said it was the largest organ in the South, and I believe they were right. We'd all get on the streetcar and go over and see the picture show. I'd always go when Ginger Rogers was playing. She was my favorite player. That girl is the most talented one they got out there in Hollywood. I don't even care to see a picture if she's not in it. She can do it all, dance, sing, act, what have you. But anyway, between shows, the lights would go down and you'd hear this man's voice saying, "And now the Alabama Theater is proud to present," he'd always say that, "proud to present, Miss Essie Rue Limeway performing on the Mighty Wurlitzer." And from far away you'd hear this music, and then, all of a sudden, here would come this huge organ rising up from the floor, and there would be Essie Rue playing her theme song, "I'm in Love with the Man in the Moon." And all the spotlights would hit her, and the sound of that organ would fill the theater and shake the rafters. Then she'd turn around and smile and never miss a note and move into another song. Before you knew it, she'd be playing "Stars Fell on Alabama" or "Life is Just a Bowl of Cherries," and her tiny little feet would just fly over those petals like butterflies. She wore ankle straps that she ordered especially from Loveman's department store. You'd think she'd put weight on everywhere, but she never did, just her body. Everybody has their good points, and she knew hers and played them up. That's why I hate to see you so down on yourself. I was telling Mrs. Otis the other day, I said, "Evelyn Couch has got the prettiest skin I ever saw," I said. "She looks like her mother had just kept her wrapped up in cotton all her life."
"Why, thank you, Mrs. Threadgood."
"Well, it's true. You don't have a wrinkle on you." I also told Mrs. Otis that I thought you ought to think about selling some of that Mary Kay cosmetics. With your skin and personality, why, I bet you could get yourself a pink Cadillac in no time. My neighbor, Mrs. Hartman, has a niece who sells it, and she made a bundle, and Mary Kay gave her a pink Cadillac as a bonus, and she's not half as pretty as you are.
Evelyn said, "Oh, Mrs. Threadgood, thank you for saying that, but I'm too old to start anything like that. They want young women."
"Evelyn Couch, how can you say that? You are still a young woman. 48 years old is just a baby. You've got half your life left to live yet. Mary Kay doesn't care how old you are. She's no spring chicken herself. Now, if it was me and I had that skin and was your age, I'd make a try at that Cadillac. Of course, I'd have to get me a driver's license, but I'd try for it anyway."
"Just think, Evelyn, if you live to be as old as I am, you've got 37 more years to go."
Evelyn laughed.
"What does it feel like to be 86, Mrs. Threadgood?"
Well, I don't feel any different. Like I say, it just creeps up on you. One day you're young, and the next day your bosoms and your chin drops, and you're wearing a rubber girdle. But you don't know you're old. Course, I can tell when I look in the mirror. Sometimes it nearly scares me to death. My neck looks just like old crepe paper, and I've got so many wrinkles, and there's nothing you can do about it. Oh, I used to have something from Avon for wrinkles, but it didn't last but about an hour, and they all came back. So I finally stopped fooling with it. I don't even put on a face anymore, just a little lotion and eyebrow pencil, so you can tell I've got eyebrows. They're white now, honey. And I'm full of liver spots. She looked at her hands. You wonder where all those little fellas come from? Then she laughed. I'm even too old to make a good picture. Francis wanted to snap a picture of me and Mrs. Otis, but I hit my head, said I might break the camera. Evelyn asked if she ever got lonesome out there. Well, yes, sometimes I do. Of course, all my people are gone, but once in a while, some of the ones from the church come to see me. But it's just hello and goodbye. That's just the way it is, hello and goodbye. Sometimes I look at my picture of Cleo and little Albert and wonder what they're up to, and dream about the old days. She smiled at Evelyn. That's what I'm living on now, honey. Dreams. Dreams of what I used to do.
Whistle Stop Cafe, Whistle Stop, Alabama, November 18, 1940. Stump was in the back room shooting at cardboard blackbirds with a rubber band gun, and Ruth was correcting papers when Iggy came banging in the back door from the annual Dill Pickle Club fishing trip. He ran and jumped up on her and nearly knocked her down. Ruth was glad to see her because she always worried whenever Iggy went off for a week or more, especially when she knew she was down at the river with Eva Bates. Stump ran out to look on the back steps. "Where's the fish?" "Well, Stump," Iggy said, "the truth is we caught a fish. It was so big we couldn't get it out of the water. We took a picture of it, though, and the picture alone weighs 20 pounds." "Oh, Aunt Iggy, you didn't catch any fish." About that time they heard, "Woo, it's me! Me and Albert come to visit." And in came a tall, sweet-looking woman with her hair twisted back in a knot, and a little retarded boy about Stump's age, coming to visit just like they had every day for the past 10 years, and they were always glad to see her. Iggy said, "Well, hey there, gal, how you doing today?" "Just fine," she said, and sat down. "How are you girls doing?" Ruth said, "Well, Ninny, we almost had some catfish for supper, but they must not have been biting." She laughed. "We're having photographs instead." Ninny was disappointed. "Oh, Iggy, I wish you had brought me a good old catfish tonight. I love a good catfish. What a shame. I can just taste him." "Ninny," Iggy said, "catfish don't bite in the dead of winter." "They don't? Well, you'd think they would be just as hungry in the winter as they are in the summer, wouldn't you?" Ruth agreed. "That's true, Iggy. Why don't they bite this time of year?" "Oh, it's not that they are not hungry. It has to do with the temperature of the worm. A catfish won't eat a cold worm, no matter how hungry it gets." Ruth looked at Iggy and shook her head, always amazed at the tales she could come up with. Ninny said, "Well, that makes sense. I hate my food to get cold myself, and I guess even if you were to heat up the worms, they would be cold by the time they got to the bottom of the river, wouldn't they? And speaking of cold, hasn't it been a cold old winter?
It's as cold as Blitzen out there.
Albert was across the room playing with Stump and shooting at the cardboard blackbirds. While Ninny was having her coffee, she had a thought.
Stump, do you reckon you could come over to my house and shoot your gun at these old blackbirds that are sitting on my telephone wires? I don't want you to hurt them. I just want you to scare them off. I think they're up there listening to my telephone calls through their feet.
Ruth, who adored Ninny, said, Oh, Ninny, you don't think that's true, do you?
Well, honey, that's what Cleo told me.
Slagtown News, Flotsam and Jetsam, by Mr. Milton James, November 19, 1940. Faith Act used to fleece woman out of $50 in cash. Mrs. Sally Jinks of 68C Howell Street Southeast was the victim of flimflam, she reported to police yesterday. Mrs. Jinks said a woman known to her as Sister Bell came to her home and through a faith act pretended to tie $50 of her money in a napkin and put it in a trunk with instructions not to open the napkin until 4 hours later. When the napkin was opened, the money was gone, the victim stated. Tonsil Robinson and E.C. Robinson are telling their friends they don't care what the other does. Missing from our alley. 8th Avenue just doesn't seem the same. Artis O'Peavy, that well-known fella about town, has seen fit to exit to the Windy City. He is sorely missed by the female population. Of that fact, you can be sure. We hear that Miss Helen Reed had to call the law over a late-night prowler trying to enter her home on Avenue F and do her bodily harm. And when the officers of the law arrived, they apprehended a gentleman hiding under the house with an ice pick in his hand who claimed that he was the Iceman. Could that gentleman have been Mr. Baby Shepherd, who heretofore had been sweet on Miss Reed? The Esquire Club is preparing for its annual limb loosener. Platter News. Ellington's Black and Tan Fantasy is a new Decca release of considerable interest and novelty. The pianist in Creole gets on a boogie-woogie kick that's odd, but effective.
10th Avenue, Chicago, Illinois, November 20th, 1940. It was raining in Chicago, and Artis O'Peavy was running down the street. He ducked into a doorway under a sign that read, Seafood Lunch, Fried Fish, 35 cents. Across the street at the RKO Alhambra, Dealers in Crime and Hoodlum Empire were showing. He felt like a fugitive himself, up here, away from home, hiding out from a dusky damsel named Electra Green. He stood there, smoking a Chesterfield cigarette and contemplating life and its turmoils. His mother had said, whenever she was down, that just the thought of her sweet Jesus could always make her spirits rise. But it hadn't been such thoughts that made Artis rise. It was the sight of a certain high-hipped, thick-lipped black beauty— And it hadn't been just his spirits that would rise and stay risen, much to the delight of said beauty. His main problem in life at the moment was that he loved too well and not too wisely. He had always played a dangerous game where the lovely lady's husbands were concerned, for Artis knew no boundaries. Every living female was his particular domain, and because of that lack of respect for territorial rights, he had often been forced to search his own body for stab wounds and broken bones, and on too many occasions had found them. After being caught with the wrong woman at the wrong time, one bronze Amazon stuck him with a corkscrew. He was much more careful after that unhappy affair, the result of which was an interesting scar, to say the least, and a natural hesitation to fool with any more women who were bigger than he was.
Still, he was a heartbreaker. He had told one too many to look for him the next night, and that's just what they wound up doing. Looking. This skinny little man, so black he was a deep royal blue, had caused a lot of trouble for the opposite sex. One gal drank a can of floor wax and topped it off with a cup of Clorox, trying to separate herself from the same world he was in. When she survived, claiming that the liquids had ruined her complexion for life, he became continually uneasy after dark because she had snuck up behind him more than once and cracked him in the head with a purse full of rocks. But this situation with Electra Green was more serious than a purse full of rocks. Electra was packing a .38 revolver that she knew how to use and had made uncouth threats pertaining to his manhood and the extermination of such after finding out he had not been true. Not once, but 8 times to be exact, with a Miss Delilah Woods, her sworn enemy, who had also left town in a hurry. As Arta stood there today in the doorway, he was hurting so bad he thought he would die. He missed Birmingham, and he wanted to go back. Every afternoon before his hasty exit from Birmingham, he had driven his blue two-tone Chevrolet with the white-wall tires up Red Mountain and had parked to watch the sunset. From up there, he could look down and see the iron and steel mills with their towering smokestacks billowing orange smoke all the way up to Tennessee. There had been nothing more beautiful to him than the city at that hour, when the sky was washed with a red and purple glow from the mills, and neon lights would start coming on all over town, twinkling and dancing throughout the downtown streets and over to Slagtown. Birmingham, the town that during the Depression had been named by FDR the hardest-hit city in the U.S., where people had been so poor that artists had known a man that would let you shoot at him for money, and a girl that had soaked her feet in brine and vinegar for 3 days trying to win a dance marathon. The place that had the lowest income per capita of any American city, and yet was known as the best circus town in the South. Birmingham, which at one time had the highest illiteracy rate, more venereal disease than any other city in America, and at the same time proudly held the record for having the highest number of Sunday school students of any city in the U.S., where Imperial Laundry trucks had once driven around town with "We Wash for White People Only" written on the side, and where darker citizens still sat behind wooden boards on streetcars that said colored and rode freight elevators in department stores. Birmingham, murder capital of the South, where 131 people had been killed in 1931 alone. All this, and yet Artis loved his Birmingham with an insatiable passion. From the south side to the north side, in the freezing cold rainy winter, when the red clay would slide down the sides of hills and run into the streets, and in the lush green summers, when the green kudzu vine covered the sides of the mountains and grew up trees and telephone poles, and the air was moist and heavy with the smell of gardenias and barbecue. He had traveled all over the country, from Chicago to Detroit, from Savannah to Charleston, and on up to New York. But there was never a time when he wasn't happy to get back to Birmingham. If there is such a thing as complete happiness, it is knowing that you are in the right place. And Artis had been completely happy from the moment he hit Birmingham. So today he made up his mind to head on home, because he knew he would rather be dead than be away any longer. He missed Birmingham like most men miss their wives. And that's just what Miss Electra Green intended to become, if she let him live, that is. As he walked by the Fife and Drum Bar, somebody played a song on the jukebox. "Way down south in Birmingham, I mean south in Alabama,
an old place where people go to dance the night away. They all drive or walk for miles to jive that southern style, slow jive, that makes you want to dance till break of day. At each junction where the town folks meet, at each function in their tux they greet you. Come on down, forget your care. Come on down, you'll find me there. So long, town. I'm heading for Tuxedo Junction now.
Slagtown News, Flotsam and Jetsam by Mr. Milton James, November 25th, 1950. Popular Birmingham bachelor marries. Miss Electra Green, daughter of Mr. and Mrs. R.C. Green, became the charming bride of Mr. Artis O. Peavy, son of Mr. and Mrs. George Peavy of Whistlestop, Alabama. Officiating at the colorful wedding rites was Dr. John W. Nixon, pastor of the First Congressional Church, while nuptial music was provided by the accomplished Mr. Lewis Jones. Radiant bride. The lovely bride was fetching in a forest green ensemble with amber accessories, mink trimmed off the face. She wore a brown felt hat, gloves and shoes to match, with a corsage of valley lilies. Miss Naughty Bird Peavy, sister of the groom, was arresting in a grape-colored woolen crepe with draped front, multicolored beaded necklace, and cerise gloves and shoes. Colorful reception. Immediately following the nuptials, a colorful wedding reception took place at the home of Mrs. Lulu Butterfork, who is prominent in the city's leading beautician circles, being both a beautician and a hairpiece specialist. Several well-known Birminghamians who attended the colorful reception were served punch, ice cream, and individual cakes, and were busy registering awe at the brilliant display of countless bridal gifts. Monday night, October 5th, at 11 o'clock, the bridal party was honored at a spicy after-supper dance with Mrs. Tonsil Robinson as hostess. Glamour marked the occasion, which saw the Little Savoy Café, scene of the select occasion, given a festive appearance by brilliantly embellished Yuletide effects and a long, heavily laden table of choice foods and viands. A hot 7-course chicken supper was served, featuring wine as an appetizer, and topped off with hot coffee and dessert. The couple will reside in the bride's home on Fountain Avenue.
Piggly Wiggly Supermarket, Birmingham, Alabama, May 19, 1986. It had been 9 long, hard days since Evelyn Couch had been on her diet, and today she woke up with a feeling of euphoria. She seemed in complete control of her life, tall and thin, and when she moved, she felt willowy and graceful. Those 9 days had been like climbing a mountain, and now she knew she had reached the top. Somehow, today, she knew in her heart that she would never eat anything as long as she lived unless it was crisp and fresh, just like she was at this very moment. When she went into the supermarket, she sprinted past the cookies and cakes and white breads and aisle 3, canned goods, where she had spent most of her shopping life, and went straight to the meat department, where she ordered chicken breasts without the skin. Then she headed over to the produce section, a place she had only visited on occasions to buy potatoes for mashing, and bought fresh broccoli and lemons and limes to cut up in her Perrier water. She stopped briefly at the magazine section to buy a town and country magazine featuring an article on Palm Beach, and then went to the express checkout counter where the checkout girl greeted her.
"Hey, Miss Couch, how are you doing today?"
"Just great, Moselle. How are you?"
"I'm fine." "Is this going to be all for you today, hon?"
"That's it."
Moselle punched up the amount. "You look awful pretty today, Miss Couch."
"Well, thank you. I feel good."
"Well, bye-bye now. You have a nice day."
"Thank you. You too."
As Evelyn was going out, a beady-eyed, mean-mouthed boy in greasy pants and a T-shirt slammed through the exit-only door and knocked Evelyn back. He brushed past, and Evelyn, still in a good mood, mumbled to herself, "Well, there's a nice gentleman." The boy turned and, with a surly look, said, "Fuck you, bitch," and went on. Evelyn was stunned. The hatred in his eyes took her breath away. She felt herself getting all shaky and started to cry. It was as if someone had hit her. She closed her eyes and told herself not to lose control. He was just a stranger. It didn't matter. Don't let it upset you. But the more she thought about it, she knew she had to make it all right. She would go on outside and wait for him and tell him that she had just been trying to make light of the situation and had not meant to hurt his feelings, and that she was sure he had come in the wrong door by mistake and hadn't realized that he had run into her. She was sure as soon as she explained it to him, he would probably feel bad and the whole thing would be over and she could go home feeling better. The boy burst out of the door carrying his six-pack and walked past her. She walked faster and caught up with him. "Excuse me, I just wanted you to know that there was no reason for you to be so mad at me in there. I was only trying to..." He shot a disgusted look at her. "Get the hell away from me, you stupid cow." Evelyn was breathless. "Excuse me? What did you call me?" He continued on, ignoring her. Now she was running after him in tears. "What did you call me? Why are you being so mean to me? What did I ever do to you? You don't even know me." He opened the door to his truck, and Evelyn, hysterical, grabbed his arm. "Why? Why are you being so mean to me?" He slammed her arm away from him and stuck his fist in her face, his eyes and face twisted with rage. "Don't fool with me, bitch, or I'll knock your fucking head off, you fat, stupid cunt." And with that, he pushed her in the chest and knocked her down. Evelyn couldn't believe what was happening. Her groceries spilled everywhere. The stringy-haired girl with the elastic halter top who had been waiting for the boy looked down at Evelyn and laughed. He got in the truck, threw it in reverse, and squealed out of the parking lot, yelling names back at Evelyn. She sat there on the ground, her elbow bleeding, old and fat and worthless all over again. The Weems Weekly, Whistle Stop Alabama's Weekly Bulletin, December 12, 1941. War starts. Grady Kilgore is in charge of the Whistle Stop Draft Board, and he says for all you boys to come on in and sign up and get it over with. It seems like lately there's nothing but troop trains and tanks passing through. It makes you wonder where they are all from and where they are going. Wilbur says the war won't last more than 6 months. I hope he's right for once. The Jolly Bells Ladies Barbershop Quartet has been invited to attend the National Convention of Ladies Barbershop Quartets in Memphis, Tennessee this spring to perform their most popular rendition of "Dip Your Brush in Sunshine and Keep on Painting Away." Reverend Scroggins asks, would the individual or individuals who are giving out his address and phone number to people looking for whiskey please stop, as his wife Arna is in the middle of a nervous condition and has broken out several times this week. Bobby Lee Scroggins joined the Navy. By the way, that service star in the window over at the cafe is for Willie Boy Peavy, Onzel's and Big George's boy, who is the first colored soldier in Troutville to join up. Dot Weems. P.S. Everybody is getting ready for the annual Christmas pageant, and because of the shortage of men in our town, Opal, myself, and Ninny Threadgood have been cast as the three wise men. T.
212 Rhodes Circle, Birmingham, Alabama, August 8, 1986. After the boy at the supermarket had called her those names, Evelyn Couch had felt violated, raped by words, stripped of everything. She had always tried to keep this from happening to her, always been terrified of displeasing men, terrified of the names she would be called if she did. She had spent her life tiptoeing around them, like someone lifting her skirt stepping through a cow pasture. She had always suspected that if provoked, those names were always close to the surface, ready to lash out and destroy her. It had finally happened. But she was still alive. So she began to wonder. It was as if that boy's act of violence toward her had shocked her into finally looking at herself and asking the questions she had avoided for fear of the answers. What was this power, this insidious threat, this invisible gun to her head that controlled her life, this terror of being called names? She had stayed a virgin so she wouldn't be called a tramp or a slut, had married so she wouldn't be called an old maid, faked orgasms so she wouldn't be called frigid, had children so she wouldn't be called barren, had not been a feminist because she didn't want to be called queer and a man-hater, never nagged or raised her voice so she wouldn't be called a bitch. She had done all that, and yet, still, this stranger had dragged her into the gutter with the names that men call women when they are angry. Evelyn wondered, why always sexual names? And why, when men wanted to degrade other men, did they call them pussies? As if that was the worst thing in the world. What have we done to be thought of that way? To be called cunt? People didn't call blacks names anymore, at least not to their faces. Italians weren't wops or dagos, and there were no more kikes, japs, chinks, or spicks in polite conversation. Everybody had a group to protest and stick up for them. But women were still being called names by men. Why? Where was our group? It's not fair. She was getting more upset by the minute. Evelyn thought, I wish Iggy had been with me. She would not have let that boy call her names. I'll bet she would have knocked him down. Then she made herself stop thinking, because all of a sudden she was experiencing a feeling that she had never felt before, and it scared her. And so, 20 years later than most women, Evelyn Couch was angry. She was angry at herself for being so scared. Soon, all that belated anger began to express itself in a strange and peculiar way. For the first time in her life, she wished she were a man, not for the privilege of having the particular set of equipment that men hold so dear. No, she wanted a man's strength, so at the supermarket she could have beaten that name-calling punk to a pulp. Of course, she realized, had she been a man, she would not have been called those names in the first place. In her fantasy, she began to look like herself, but with the strength of 10 men. She became Superwoman, and in her mind she beat that bad-mouthed boy over and over again until he lay in the parking lot, broken and bleeding, begging for mercy. Ha! Thus, in her 48th year, the incredible secret life of Mrs. Evelyn Couch of Birmingham, Alabama, began. Few people who saw this plump, pleasant-looking, middle-aged, middle-class housewife out shopping or doing other menial everyday chores could guess that in her imagination she was machine-gunning the genitals of rapists and stomping abusive husbands to death in her specially designed wife-beater boots. Evelyn had even made up a secret code name for herself, a name feared around the world, Tawanda the Avenger. And while Evelyn went about her business with a smile, Tawanda was busy poking child molesters with electric cattle prods until their hair stood on end. She placed tiny bombs inside Playboy and Penthouse magazines that would explode when they were opened. She gave dope dealers overdoses and left them in the streets to die, forced that doctor who had told her mother she had cancer to walk down the street naked while the entire medical profession, including dentists and oral hygienists, jeered and threw rocks. A merciful avenger, she always waited until he finished his walk and then beat his brains out with a sledgehammer. Tawanda was able to do anything she wanted. She went back in time and punched out Paul for writing that women should remain silent. Tawanda went to Rome and kicked the Pope off the throne and put a nun there, with the priests cooking and cleaning for her for a change. Tawanda appeared on Meet the Press, and with a calm voice, a cool eye, and a wry smile, debated everyone who disagreed with her until they became so defeated by her brilliance that they burst into tears and ran off the show. She went to Hollywood and ordered all the leading men to act opposite women of their own age, not 20-year-old girls with perfect bodies. She allowed rats to chew all slumlords to death and sent food and birth control methods for men as well as women to the poor people of the world. And because of her vision and insight, she became known the world over as Tawanda the Magnanimous, Righter of Wrongs and Queen Without Compare. Tawanda ordained that an equal number of men and women would be in the government and sit in on peace talks. She and her staff of crack chemical scientists would find a cure for cancer and invent a pill that would let you eat all you want and not gain weight. People would be forced to get a license to have children and must be found fit financially and emotionally. No more starving or battered children. Jerry Falwell would be responsible for the raising of all illegitimate children who had no homes. No kittens or puppies would be put to sleep, and they would be given a state of their own, maybe New Mexico or Wyoming. Teachers and nurses would receive the same salary as professional football players. She would stop the construction of all condos, especially ones with red tile roofs. And Van Johnson would be given a show of his own. He was one of Tawanda's favorites. Graffiti offenders were to be dipped in a vat of indelible ink. No more children of famous parents could write books. And she'd personally see to it that all the sweet men and daddies who had worked so hard would each receive a trip to Hawaii and an outboard motor to go with it. Tawanda went to Madison Avenue and took control of all the fashion magazines. All models weighing under 135 were fired, and wrinkles suddenly became sexually desirable. Low-fat cottage cheese was banned from the land forever. Ditto carrot sticks. Why, just yesterday Tawanda had marched into the Pentagon, taken all the bombs and missiles away, and had given them toys to play with instead, while her sisters in Russia were doing the same thing. Then she went on the 6 o'clock nightly news and gave the entire military budget to all the people in the United States over 65. Tawanda would be so busy all day that Evelyn was exhausted by bedtime. No wonder. Tonight, while Evelyn was cooking dinner, Tawanda had just put a room full of porno and child exploitation film producers to death. And later, as Evelyn was washing the dishes, Tawanda was in the process of single-handedly blowing up the entire Middle East to prevent the Third World War. And so when Ed yelled from the den for another beer, somehow, before Evelyn could stop her, Tawanda yelled back, "Screw you, Ed!" He very quietly got up from his recliner and came into the kitchen.
Evelyn, are you all right?
The Weems Weekly, Whistle Stop Alabama's Weekly Bulletin, February 9, 1943. War speeds up. My other half is working two shifts, along with just about everyone else over at the railroad, since the iron and steel industry is working overtime, and I'm one lonesome gal these days. But if he's helping out Uncle Sam and our boys, I guess I can take it. Tommy Glass and Ray Limeway write from camp to say hello. By the way, has anybody seen Iggy's and Ruth's Victory Garden by the old Threadgood place? Iggy said that Sipsy grew butter beans the size of silver dollars. I can't get anything but a few sweet potatoes over at my place. Three of the members of the Jolly Bells Ladies Barbershop Quartet, me and Biddy Louise Otis and Ninnie Threadgood, went to Birmingham and had dinner at Britling's Cafeteria, and then went to see our own Essie Rue Limeway. The picture playing was not half as good as the show in between. We are mighty proud. We wanted to tell everyone in the theater that she was our friend. Ninnie did turn to the person next to her and inform him that Essie Rue was her sister-in-law. By the way, don't forget to save rubber. Dot Weems. P.S. Who says we are the weaker sex? Poor Dwayne Glass fainted at his own wedding last Sunday and had to be held up by his bride-to-be throughout the entire ceremony. He said he felt much better after it was over, though. He leaves for the Army right after his honeymoon. Whistle Stop, Alabama, January 12, 1944. In Birmingham, at the big L&N Terminal train station, a brass band and a crowd of 500 people had gathered to welcome home the returning sons, husbands, and brothers, war heroes all. The flags were waving already, waiting for the 6:20 from Washington, D.C. But tonight, the train made its first stop 20 minutes outside of Birmingham. And down at the end of the platform was a black family waiting for their son. Quietly, the wooden box was lifted off the baggage coach and placed on the cart that would take him over the tracks to Troutville. Artis, Jasper, and Naughty Bird walked behind Onzel, Sipsy, and Big George. As they walked by, Grady Kilgore, Jack Butts, and all the railroad boys took their hats off and stood at attention. There were no flags or bands or any medals, just a cardboard name tag on the box with PFC WCPV written on it. But across the street in the window of the cafe, there was a flag and a service star in the window and a sign that read, "Welcome home, Willie Boy." Ruth and Iggy and Stump had already gone over to Troutville to wait with the others. Sweet Willie Boy, wonderful Counselor Peavy, the boy who had been accepted at Tuskegee Institute, the smart one, the one who was going to be a lawyer, a leader of his people, a shining light from the back roads of Alabama to Washington, D.C. Willie Boy, the one who had the chance to make it, had gotten himself killed after a bar fight by a black soldier named Winston Lewis, from Newark, New Jersey. Willie Boy had been talking about his daddy, Big George, who, whenever his name was mentioned down home, blacks and whites alike would always say, "Now there's a man." But Winston Lewis had said that any man working for whites, especially in Alabama, was nothing but a low-down, ignorant, stupid, shuffling Uncle Tom. In order to survive, Willie Boy had been trained not to react to insults and to disguise even the tiniest glimmer of aggressiveness or anger. But tonight, when Winston spoke, he thought of his daddy and crashed a beer bottle into the soldier's face and sent him sprawling on the floor, out like a light. The next night, while he was asleep, Willie Boy's throat had been cut from ear to ear. Winston Lewis then went AWOL.
The army didn't much care. They had pretty much had it with the knife fights among the colored troops, and Willie Boy was sent home in a box. At the funeral, Ruth and Smokey and all the thread goods were in the front row of the church, and Iggy spoke on behalf of the family. The preacher